And it becomes incredibly emotional because those just aren't names of the flag. Those are people. And when I come back and they say, thank you for doing that, I tell them, in all honesty, I'm very grateful for the opportunity to be a part of their lives, you know, because we all need that support system. We all need that hope. We all need something to push us forward.
Welcome to the Resilient People Podcast. My name is Janet Fanacki. I speak with extraordinary, regular people from around the world who are admired for their resilience. They've overcome major challenges and found a purpose from it to help others be resilient too. In this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with extreme adventurer, Sean Swarner. You might be asking, what makes someone an extreme adventurer? Sean has scaled the world's 7 tallest summits, hiked to the South and North Poles, making him a member of the exclusive Explorers Grand Slam. If that's not enough, he's achieved it all with only one functioning lung. When he was just 13 years old, Sean was diagnosed with stage 4 Hodgkin's lymphoma and given 3 months to live. Following aggressive treatments, he was lucky to kick his cancer. But his fight would be far from over, because when he was 16, doctors discovered that Sean had developed Askin's sarcoma in his right lung. He underwent radiation that destroyed his lungs' capability to function. After 4 awfully difficult years, he was declared cancer-free. Not taking these experiences for granted, he knew that it was his time to really live life. But Sean always kept the people who were continuing to fight cancer in the forefront of his mind, aiming to inspire them to conquer their own mountains. As someone who has spent his entire life overcoming challenges, I was keen to learn what inspires Sean, where he gets his resilience from, and what standing on top of the world, both actually and figuratively, is like given everything he's been through. I spoke with Sean Swarner, the GOAT of extreme explorers, from his home in Puerto Rico and from mine in Toronto.
16, 17, so you'd already gone through 2 really serious cancer diagnoses. I've got 2 kids, you know, they're 19 and 21. And I remember when, you know, being 16, 17, I remember myself being 16, 17. What your thoughts are like, you know, what was it like for you? I mean, you know, you probably still kept in touch with your other friends. How did you kind of keep yourself out of your head or in your head? Like, how did you kind of help yourself through finding a positive mindset? Who helped you with that?
Because I was in and out of the hospital so many times, I bet you I was the only 13-year-old who actually wanted to go to school. I didn't want to go to the hospital. Like, I want to go to school. But how did I, who helped me with that mindset? Honestly, I think it was a moment when I was 13 and I was about 3 months into chemo. And I remember waking up and sitting on the edge of my bed and my pillow, I remember just seeing it off to my left side. I remember it just being covered in hair. And I knew I was going to be losing my hair at some point, because a lot of people don't understand is chemotherapy doesn't attack just the cancer cells. It attacks rapidly dividing cells, which is what hair follicles are. And same thing with, you know, eyebrows, nails, everything. And I remember running to the bathroom and just staring at myself in the mirror and just kind of combing my hands through my hair, thinking I could potentially stop it from falling out or do something. So I went to the shower and I started washing my head again, which was obviously normal. But what didn't feel normal was how the water was hitting my scalp as opposed to soaking my hair and going in. So then I also remember I was, because of the prednisone, I was 60 pounds overweight. I collapsed to the bottom of the shower floor on my hands and knees, just sobbing, just absolutely weeping. And I remember crying my eyeballs out, pulling chunks of hair out of the drain so the water could go down. And when I was in there, in that shower, all my hair fell out. It happened all at once. And I also remember thinking about my life. And again, I'm 13. And I remember thinking about what my friends were going through that same morning while they were getting ready for school. For example, across the street, 2 houses down, his name was Jerry. He was probably getting ready. Back then, I think the most popular shoe was like the Reebok Pump or something like that. He was probably at home going, you know, 26, 27, 28, perfect. And worried about the perfect hairstyle, you know, being popular, worried about being with the in crowd, whatever it might be. And none of that mattered to me because I was worried about living. I was worried about surviving. And it made me see life from a completely different perspective than my friends. And then the same thing happened again when I was 16. So it kind of reinforced that. And I think that's where my perspective comes from now. But how I learned that positive perspective was, I think it was in that moment when I decided that I had two choices. I could live, I could fight for my life, or I could give up and die. But it was also in that same moment where I decided that I didn't want to focus on not dying. I wanted to focus on living. And it works for so many different aspects of life. They teach you if you're driving in a car, whatever you're focused on is where you're going to go. If you're sliding on ice and you're thinking to yourself, I don't want to hit that telephone pole. Well, you know where you're going to go because you're trying, don't go there. That's exactly what's going to happen. You know, it's like putting a kid in a room with a button that says, do not push. And what's going to happen? Kid's going to push the button. So I decided a long time ago, I wanted to be motivated by what I wanted, not the avoidance of what I didn't want. That was one of the big ones. And then obviously everything came together at the perfect moment, perfect time. It's not just mindset that's going to cure you of cancer. You know, it's just everything culminating at the right time, right place, right, whatever it might be. And I just feel completely blessed to have had the life that I've lived. It first started with this, with the thought. And then after the thought, then I had to see myself doing it. So I had to believe it was possible, then see it was possible, and then start putting action into it. And the first thing I did was literally my first goal was to crawl 8 feet from the hospital bed to the bathroom. And without getting too descriptive, it was basically so I wouldn't soil the sheet. You know, as a 16-year-old, someone who's vomiting all over himself and going to the bathroom in the bed because he physically can't move to the bathroom in time quick enough. It's embarrassing. That's what happened. And the first thing I did was I just made that little tiny change as opposed to thinking, okay, well, you know, I'm going to go run around the block or I'm going to go run around wherever. The first thought I had was I just want to make it to the bathroom.
It's been incredible. But do you remember a point where you were done your treatments for your second cancer and you were able to enjoy your childhood because you'd gone through so much already in your teen years? Do you remember a point where you could finish off your high school years and enjoy just hanging out with your friends and being goofy and being selfish without having to worry about your health?
Absolutely. It was called college. I don't know if you ever seen the movie Animal House? You're looking at Belushi. I was having a great time. I started off molecular bio thinking I was going to cure cancer and splice genes. But if you're partying too much, you find out very quickly it's difficult to pass organic chemistry and immunology if you don't open the book. I kind of relived my high school years, you know, because they were taken from me. I was there for 4.5 years. I changed my major the beginning of my junior year to psychology, where I wanted to be a psychologist for cancer patients. And then I decided, okay, I needed to start focusing on my future. And I think the issue was going back to the two cancers, fighting through life. Day in, day out, you know, going to bed so many nights, not knowing if you're going to wake up the next morning, that becomes your future. And then all of a sudden the doctor says, okay, hey, you're in remission, family, friends, all that support group that you had disappears because everybody thinks you're fine. But now I'm left to my own devices to move forward and think, okay, well, what am I going to do now? Go live your future. Go live your life. I don't even know where to begin. I kind of had to start over.
Yeah, that makes sense. So you've done so much since surviving your cancer diagnoses. You've climbed all 7 of the world's largest summits. You've done the South and the North Pole. You've completed an Ironman. To me, you almost seem invincible. I mean, I look at you as being almost superhuman. You know, I think the fact that you've done this all, for those that don't know this, you've done it all with one lung. So my question to you, first of all, I want to call you the goat of explorers. But the question is, what you've done is so uncommon and your goal is to inspire everyone, but especially cancer patients. How do you do that in a way that they can relate to you as someone other than a superhero?
Because I know what it's like going through the treatment. I know what it's like having no hope. I know what it's like not having that desire. I know what it's like waking up in the morning and having the mouth sores from the treatment. You know, I know what it's like to have no hope, which is exactly why I do what I do, to give them some hope. When people hear my story, I get a response that's usually one of two things. The first one is, wow, you really make me feel lazy. And then the second one is, wow, that's really inspirational. And the person who says, wow, you make me feel lazy, I tell them, look, you don't have to climb Mount Everest. You don't have to do all these things. Your Mount Everest might be literally getting off the couch and walking around the block. Just start somewhere. Just do something that you're passionate about.
When you're in training mode, describe a day, what that looks like. What would you be eating? What would you be doing as far as when you wake up to when you go to bed?
So when I'm in training mode, processed food is gone. Sugar, gone. I will do honey. At home, I usually wake up and I'll have, the first thing I drink is a couple tablespoons of apple cider vinegar mixed with water. Slug it down. I've heard it's good for you. And I've learned to like the taste, but I haven't. You know, I've done that for a while. It's just kind of like taking vitamins. And then I'll make some coffee that actually has honey in it with some cocoa. Let's see, some cayenne pepper and cinnamon. That gets me going. I will wake up again. I'll head to, because I'll be back in Colorado. I will head to, there's a mini incline. So stairs I go, and I live at about 6,300 feet, I think. So I will go up. There are 200 steps, and I will carry a backpack that has, I don't know, 50 pounds in it maybe. And I'll just go up and down. I'll start doing it five times. And I know I'm ready to go up Kilimanjaro because I take a group up every year as a fundraiser for a cancer charity. And I know I'm ready to go when I can do that 10 times over and over and over and over again without my legs turning into noodles. So that's when I know I'm ready to go. And then I'll also combine Monday, Wednesday, Friday running. But also when I come back from the morning hike up the, it's called the mini incline, my wife and I will also do yoga. So it's a lot of different things. It's not one specific thing. But for the North Pole, when I was training for that, it's very similar to, like, say, running the New York City Marathon. If you're training for a marathon, you're not going to hop in the pool and swim laps back and forth. You're going to go out and do the exercise that you're actually going to be doing while you're there. So that's why I was pulling the tires and pulling the Jeep around the neighborhood, simulating the sled being pulled behind me. But for the most part, it's mainly physical. And every single morning I have a routine, a mental routine, and every single evening I have a mental routine as well.
Yeah, I was going to say the one common thing that seems to be whether you're in training or whether you're not is you build activity into your day, no matter what.
There's something called the compound effect. And if you just do something little here, little here, little here, little here, perfect example, my wife and I are doing it now. If you do 100 push-ups a day and 100 crunches a day, and you can do them whatever, like throughout the day, you can start with 10 in the morning and just, as before you go to bed, just make sure you do 100. You know, at the end of the month, you've done 3,000 push-ups and 3,000 crunches. And so many people don't understand. Like, they don't grasp the idea that if you just do a bunch of little things, those little things add up to a huge difference. It's the same thing with the media. It's the same thing with the news. It's the same thing with social media. It's the same thing with anything that you're ingesting. Because there's that saying that you are what you eat, but you are what you consume. And that's what people need to understand.
You're incredible, man. Like, really, you really are. Do you feel like you're incredible?
Yeah, I'm just a normal guy doing normal things. It's just the only difference is right here. I push myself a little bit more every day. And it's kind of funny because I'm a member of a group called on Facebook called One Lungers Unite. Someone who's 20 something, she posted, you know, I can't walk around the block. I can't do this, you know, because she had her lung removed. And I just told her, asked her to DM me. I asked her and told her my story and told her, well, it just takes one step. And I was like, what can you do starting today to help you expand your diaphragm and your lungs, or your lung, I suppose. And she said, well, every day, usually what I do is I take an Uber to work. Okay, well, maybe you could walk. So she tried that the first day, then she did it the second day, then she did it the third day. And she's like, this is fantastic. And I think that's the only difference is so many people just, they need that little nudge sometimes, you know, including myself. You know, I need support and just like everybody else.
You talk about micro changes. Is that an example of a micro change that you suggest to people?
Absolutely. Just find one thing, you know, for you too. Just what's one thing you could do tomorrow to help you become more of who you want to be? One thing. Because in so many different programs out there, you get a workbook that's like 9 inches thick and they have you doing 1,000 things a day. Like, you're never going to finish that. Just do one thing. Pick another one thing. Now that you have one habit, build another habit, then another habit, then another habit. So along with being mindful and doing micro changes, that's called the compound effect. I think one of the biggest things I bookend my day. And as opposed to waking up in the morning and turning on the news, or waking up and getting on my phone and going on social media, because I mean, now more than ever, most people, when they wake up, they either they're on their phone before they go to the bathroom or while they're going to the bathroom. It's probably one of the two. You know, they grab it while on their way to the bathroom. And then what do? They just mindlessly scroll through social media, which is filled with how much negativity. Yes, there's positive stuff on there, but it doesn't speak to people. So they might like a post, they might like a video or a quote or something, but they don't act on that, you know, and because it's so saturated, it doesn't mean as much as it used to. You know, people can read a quote and they're like, oh, that's fantastic. And then literally 30 seconds later, they're doing something else. They're gone. So every morning I wake up, before I do anything, I have an affirmation I tell myself. And pick whatever affirmation means most to you based around your personal core values. Mine is, yesterday's gone, there's nothing I can do about it. Tomorrow may never come. So no matter what happens today, today is the best day ever. And through the day, I'm always conscious of picking out what's good in things, not bad. You know, I see opportunities, not obstacles. And at the end of the day, as opposed to complaining to my wife, Julissa, about what didn't go right and watching the news and seeing in the world everything that went wrong, we talk about, and sometimes depending on where we are, we write down five things we're grateful for that happened that day. Not that happened, like, you know, I'm grateful for my house. I'm grateful for my health. I'm grateful for my wife. Yes, that's overall general stuff. But I'm grateful for the fact that I had the opportunity to do whatever. You know, and I write down five things I'm grateful for. And then I journal about one of them. And I literally say, I'm grateful for blank, one of those five, because blank. And again, that helps me tap back into my personal core values. And I just constantly reinforce what means most to me. And I put most of my energy into building what means most to myself.
What was one of the scariest moments for you in your adventures, and how did you push through?
Oh, that's easy. It was when I was on the crux of the climb on Denali, which was the last of the seven summits. And it was up in Alaska. And I remember literally I fell 100 feet. I was roped up to my climbing partner, and we had a 50 feet of rope between the two of us. So I fell 50 feet to him and then 50 feet below him. It's amazing how different perspectives perceive time. So for him, he said it was over like that. For me, I can remember starting to fall. And you know how some, like, your brain works so quickly sometimes. I remember I was sliding down on my back, and I was thinking to myself, well, this isn't good. I should probably try to stop.
Were you that calm?
I was. It was really weird. So then I rolled over and I self-arrested, meaning I took the blade of my axe into the snow. And I was also, like I said, roped up to my climbing partner. And I remember snow shooting up between my glacier glasses and my eyes. And I slowly came to a stop, you know, gathered my wits about me, climbed back up to where I fell. And I belayed him in to this safe spot. And by, at that point, my adrenaline was shot. You know, my hands were shaking. I was shaking. I was freaking out. And I told him, we have to go back down to camp. So we got back down to camp. And I was sitting in my tent, looked up, and I said, you know, give me a sign. Let me know if it's my time to be here or not. And as I went back into my tent, my hood caught my glacier glasses and snapped them right in half. I looked up, I was like, dude, I kind of needed those.
You know? What was that telling you, to stop?
Yeah, I was like, yeah, exactly. So how did I deal with that? I went home. Came back the next day. I've always trusted my gut. And I've always trusted, you know, for me, it's the big guy and signs and everything else. And for me, that was enough. I knew the mountain was always there. And I learned this a long time ago, even before I climbed Everest. I know life is worth a hunk of rock and ice, because, you know, you can always go back to the mountain. It's been there for eons. I haven't been. You haven't been. So just trust your gut and go back later.
So your takeaway was step back, reevaluate.
Absolutely. So many times you have to take a step back. And what that does is it gives you a different perspective, and it potentially makes you stronger going into it again. You know, it's not necessarily a setback. It's not necessarily a failure. It's just an opportunity to learn how to build yourself stronger.
A movie was made about Sean Swarner's journey to reach the North Pole. True North on Amazon Prime follows the two-time cancer survivor as he attempts to complete the Explorer's Grand Slam by hiking through grueling conditions towards his goal of reaching the North Pole.
So in the movie, I found myself getting super emotional by the end. And particularly at the moment where, I'm not going to ruin it for anybody because I think it's, you know, public that you've reached the North Pole. But when you got to that point, you broke down. Can you describe to me what was going through your head? What had you so emotional?
I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm trying to think how to phrase it without giving too much away. On the summit of Everest, which was the first of the seven summits I climbed, first mountain ever. And by ever, I mean first big mountain, not like training. It was the first mountain I climbed. And the whole time I was climbing, I had a flag that was, you know, maybe a foot by 2 feet that had names of people touched by cancer. And it could be someone who was a survivor, someone who was going through treatment, or unfortunately, as we both know, someone who passes away in memory of someone. And I had that flag folded up in my cap pocket every time I went up the mountain. And it was always a close to my heart and as a reminder of my goals and my inspiration. I did that on the highest mountain on every continent, you know, and left the flag up there, essentially forever commemorating the struggle of cancer patients worldwide. And I did the same thing for the South Pole and the North Pole, which was the culmination of the Grand Slam, which is the seven summits and the North and South Poles, which I still think sounds like a Denny's breakfast platter. But when I got to the North Pole, there was a flag that you'll see in the movie that, I don't know, 6.5 feet by 4 feet maybe. And it had thousands of people on there. And it's not just names, it's people. And thousands of people were pushing me because that flag was in my sled. Thousands of people were pushing me the whole way up there. And it was a culmination of the past, I think it was 15 years completing the Explorer's Grand Slam. And it was kind of an homage for everyone touched by cancer. It was very emotional to me, and it still is, knowing how many people in the world are touched by cancer and how many people don't have hope and how many people need something to get them going. But at the same time, I get my inspiration from those exact same people I'm trying to inspire. So it's kind of like this circle of hope or this circle of inspiration where I want to inspire people and I get my inspiration from them. And it's just, I want to feed off of each other's energy.
That was my next question. Who inspires you and how do they do that? I think you just answered that.
Absolutely. Because on my expeditions, I can always pick up the satellite phone and say, hey, you know, I think I'm done. Get me out of here. Helicopter comes in, insurance kicks in, pulls me out. But people who are fighting for their lives can't necessarily pick up their cell phone and say, you know, I think I'll come back next year. It doesn't work that way.
What's the reaction been from patients and families who have signed those flags from when you come back from your expeditions? What have you heard back from them?
It's always emotional. It's always, you know, thank you for doing what you're doing. It's always them being very grateful for the opportunity to get someone essentially memorialized at the top of the world or at the top of wherever I'm going. So again, I take a group up Kilimanjaro every year as a fundraiser for a cancer charity. And we pay for a survivor's trip free of charge. And that survivor then, his or her responsibility is to raise funds for next year's survivor, kind of paying it forward. Anyone can go. So anyone can join the group. And we have a flag that we always leave up there. And we share the flag and everybody gets to carry the flag at least some point on the trip. It's 7 days up and down the mountain. And it becomes incredibly emotional because those just aren't names of the flag. Those are people. And when I come back and they say, thank you for doing that, I tell them, in all honesty, I'm very grateful for the opportunity to be a part of their lives. Yeah, because we all need that support system. We all need that hope. We all need something to push us forward.
Can you describe to me when you reach the summit for those of us who may never be doing this? Leave a flag up there. What else do you see when you get up to the summit?
A lot of snow, a lot of clouds, and a lot of other peaks. On Everest, it was like a sea of clouds and mountain peaks as island. It was just unbelievable. And going up Kilimanjaro, I tell people, we leave at like 11 p.m. or midnight, and we summit around 8 or 9 the next morning. So it's a long night and it's super cold. But the issue is when you get to a certain point, you can actually see the sunrise coming up, you know, and it kind of comes up over Kenya, which is just stellar. It's the most amazing sunrise you've ever seen in your entire life.
How long do you stay up at a summit?
You know, it all depends. If the weather's good, we'll stay up there for 30 minutes. If the weather's not, literally long enough to take a picture and go back down.
Okay. And what else do you find up there? You've got your flag up there. What else do people leave?
One year, I did two back-to-back trips. So I went up the mountain, came back down, and took another group up there. I left a Snickers bar at the summit.
Oh, how come? Why Snickers?
Well, that way, so that when I went back up to the summit again, I could go find it and eat it.
Oh, that's hilarious.
I'm pretty sure the birds ate it. It was gone. But people take, you know, pictures of others. People take crosses. People take clothes. People take shoes. I took a kite once to fly it around. And people bring anything that is personal to them. You know, I think the biggest one is probably photos of loved ones.
Yeah, that would be emotional too, just to go up there and see all that.
Absolutely.
What do you want people to walk away knowing or doing to be resilient?
I want people to know and understand and feel, not just know, but completely feel that everyone is capable of more. You just have to believe it yourself. A perfect example is everybody, again, going back to Killy, you know, the people I take up Kilimanjaro, my wife, anybody, I tell them all the time, like, I wish you could see the potential in you that I do. You know, I wish you could see yourself from my perspective, because so many people have these limiting beliefs about themselves. And I do too. Everybody does. You just have to learn how to break through those limiting beliefs and understand that you are a lot more powerful than you think.
What an amazing guy. I've got lots of great takeaways, as I'm sure you do, from this conversation with Sean. Make micro changes to get to your goal. Tackling any challenge with small steps is way more doable than getting discouraged by the magnitude of it and giving up. When you come across a challenge, step back, take time to reevaluate, and then go at it again. Seriously evaluate how you bookend your day to maintain resilience and a positive mindset. Speaking with Sean made me feel that with the right mindset, anything is really possible. I want to thank Sean Swarner for joining me, and I'd like to thank you for listening to this episode of Resilient People. To learn more about Sean, visit seanswarner.com. This episode was produced by Edit Audio with Kanika Codrington, Sophie Shin, and Steph Coburn. For more stories of resilience from extraordinary, regular people, subscribe to the Resilient People podcast wherever you listen. Episodes come out with a new guest every 2 weeks. In between those episodes, I've also launched a new segment to Resilient People called Revelations. Each episode of Revelations is just a few minutes long, and I dive a little deeper on topics from the full episodes and research I learn along the way to give you some tips and takeaways. I hope you enjoy it. If you or someone you know is considered to be resilient and has created something to help others, I'd love to hear from you. Write me, info@resilientpeople.ca. Find me on Twitter and Instagram, or go to resilientpeople.ca. Thanks for listening. Till next time, I'm Janet Finacki. Bye for now.
Divorce sucks, but it doesn't have to be all bad. Hi, I'm Leanne Townsend, a family law lawyer and partner at the law firm Brody Thorning LLP. I'm also the host of the Divorcing Well podcast. Divorcing Well aims to help provide listeners with the tools and knowledge they need to support themselves legally, financially, mentally, emotionally, physically, and spiritually. I want listeners to tune into Divorcing Well because they are looking for the knowledge and inspiration to get them through the rough days. And on the positive days, they will gain the tools that they need to heal and move through the various stages of grief that divorce can bring. Each week, I interview an expert or a guest who's been out there in the trenches going through divorce themselves, sharing their stories, their knowledge, their inspiration with listeners, so that ultimately I can help them to divorce well. You can find my podcast on all podcast platforms or visit my website at www.leannetownsend.ca.